Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're on the road again, hence our mobile studio is in operation, and in that studio, I'm very pleased to say, we are joined virtually by one of our favorite and most faithful contributors. His name is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man who, in addition to his service in uniform, quite distinguished service at that, has also served our country as a foreign service officer. He's been a businessman based forward deployed, if you will, in Japan for quite some time, including for once quite formidable American companies like Motorola. So he knows a bit about the Chinese Communist Party and the kind of warfare that it has waged against us, including taking out companies like Motorola, but also what it has in mind, perhaps, if it decides to go from unrestricted warfare to the shooting kind. The subject, in fact, of his new book, When China Attacks, A Warning to America. Colonel Newsom, it is always good to have you with us, but this is a very important moment, I think, and we're especially pleased that you're available, and thank you for giving us generously of your time. Welcome back, sir.
Sure, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I say it's a particularly important time because the Biden administration is feverishly ramping up its efforts to, kowtow, I think is the technical term for it, the Chinese word for prostrating oneself to the emperor as a means of demonstrating your diminished role, your supplicant status. We saw the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, do it recently, as you know. And now, as we speak, the Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, is on to Beijing for a similar purpose. How do you think she's likely to be received based on how they treated Tony Blinken?
Well, she will get the usual treatment. She might actually get a little better treatment, actually, than Blinken did. And that's because she has something they desperately want in Beijing, and that is for the Americans to end the tariffs which President Trump put on the Chinese and which the Biden administration has kept. After complaining when Trump did it that it was a bad thing, it was hurting Americans, well, they've actually kept it. Also, they want the Americans to relax particularly the technology sanctions that we put on them, made it a little harder for them to get semiconductors, for example. And they think that Yellen might be able to apply some pressure to get that done. So they may actually give her better treatment than the abject humiliation they gave Secretary Blinken, who took it. So as I say, it may be a more cordial meeting because, as I say, they really want something from her.
Well, I think that's true, but I can't believe that they're not going to indulge in a little humiliation along the trail, partly because she is so hapless, I think, honestly. I can't imagine they'll be able to contain themselves altogether. But you're right. The other thing that I presume they're very anxious to help her promote is the idea that we mustn't contemplate disengaging or decoupling from China. Instead, she's all about what she calls de-risking. Do you have any idea what de-risking actually, excuse me, do you have any idea, Colonel, what de-risking actually means?
Oh, I think they think it means a little bit less than full decoupling, but nobody has ever talked about completely decoupling or just not doing anything at all with China. So they look at it as sort of an adult view of this childish tantrum of decoupling. And the idea is that you can just choose some specific areas where you reduce or eliminate your dependency on the Chinese, and then everything's good. You go back to normal. But it's really a question of sophistry. What it does is it does not admit that the Chinese regime is out to kill us. And that has to be your fundamental start point.
That's a rather big risk, wouldn't you say?
If kind of, and plus, unfortunately, they've got the capability to do it. So it's trying to have your cake and eat it too, but I don't see how it's going to work. But this is there's names that are getting thrown around. As you know, you'll find one side, for example, saying, well, you want to decouple, and that's a red herring. Nobody is actually talking about that. What they are talking about is doing these things economically and otherwise that actually build up our main enemy and that have created an immense dependency on our part that we're seeing the results of daily. That's what you want to get after.
These supply chain dependencies, mm-hmm. for example, for all manner of things, including our medicines, for heaven's sakes, among many, many other things. You know, as it happens, Colonel Newsom, we're going to have what is in prospect as we speak, but will be in the rearview mirror when this program airs, a very important webinar today of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, which you are, of course, a very important member. And it will be addressing the case of Neil Shen and Sequoia Capital, enablers, we call it, of the great tech heist by China. And just one example of how we have been enabling through not only technology transfers engineered by people like Sequoia's Neil Shen, but also, of course, their counterparts on Wall Street with trillions of dollars sent to China, with which the Chinese have, of course, enhanced the supply chain dependency by waging economic warfare against us, enhanced the military capabilities to have a shooting war with us, and so on. In short, I mean, this is a moment when, whether one calls it decoupling or disengaging or simply ending the kind of practices that have brought us to this perilous state of, well, as you describe in your new book, when China attacks, not if or maybe they will, but when China attacks, it's obviously necessary that we have a course correction, and de-risking doesn't seem to me to be anywhere near what's required. Your thoughts?
You know, it could be, you know, if you do it right, because that would mean getting away from a lot of things you're doing with China. But the way the word is used, it's really just a partial resolution of the problems. Just do a little bit, and then otherwise,
or a deflection altogether. I don't want to. I don't want to give them more credit than they actually deserve. Yeah,
one thing you do notice,
go ahead.
It's worth mentioning, and you see it a lot with financial types, business types, and Janet Yellen's an example of this. That these people generally know one thing very well, or pretty well, and that's finance. And they usually only know one part of finance, but they seem to know nothing about what you would call foreign affairs, security matters. And you see it in the way that they, when they talk and open their mouths, you see they have like heard about the People's Republic of China being a potential problem about 30 minutes ago. And as I say, it's a problem, but you see it with her, but you see it throughout the financial world, the business world. Sometimes there is an understanding, but there's a real willingness and an intentional ignoring of the problem because you think you can make some money. So it doesn't help our country.
Yeah. Well, to the contrary, I think it's deeply harmful to the country, which will be the point of this webinar today and so many others, including quite a number that you've participated in. And I want to encourage all of our listeners to visit this incredible trove of webinars at presentdangerchina.org. Colonel, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps, retired, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In 1944, Adolf Hitler ordered his army to torch Paris rather than let the city be liberated intact. As it became clear he was being disobeyed, the Nazi dictator frantically demanded to know, "Is Paris burning?" Thankfully, it wasn't then, but the capital of France is burning today at the hands of adherents to another totalitarian ideology, best described as Sharia supremacism, who now occupy hundreds of no-go zones across the country. And it is not just Paris that is in flames. In recent days, jihadists have taken to the streets in city after city, ostensibly to protest the killing of a Muslim youth by police during a traffic stop. The uprisings may prove, however, to be the start of a civil war that unassimilable Islamist immigrants have long aspired to launch in France and far beyond. Think Summer of Love on steroids. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are continuing our very, very timely conversation with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a senior fellow, I'm proud to say, of our Center for Security Policy, and as I mentioned, a very, very significant contributor to the Committee on the Present Danger, China, of which he is a member. Colonel, one of the pieces that I want to tease out with you in connection with your new book, When China Attacks, is the distinct possibility, you and I have discussed this in the past as well, but I want to bring it up to the moment, that there will be attacks against the United States as well as Taiwan and perhaps bases we have overseas and territory, you know, like Guam, that could involve the home front in a very significant way. One of the further indicators, as they say in the intelligence business, that that might be in the offing, is the presence at and now coming across the southern border of the United States of, by some estimates, 10,000 unaccompanied, military-aged, very fit, young Chinese men, seemingly carrying backpacks and canteens that look an awful lot like they've been issued to them by some central authority, and are reported to be moving in what appear to be groups or units. What do you make of that particular migration and its implications for when China attacks?
Well, it's not good. It's potentially a huge threat, and somebody needs to get to the bottom of it and ideally not let it happen. Unfortunately, it has happened, and it is happening. And boy, if there was ever grounds for impeaching somebody, this is it. It is something you absolutely have to get a handle on. You know, just, if you don't believe me, just read the Chinese press for a week. Listen to the tone of it. And it is all about defeating America, bringing down the United States, the democratic system. And if you can find anything which is even sort of nice or positive in there, let me know. But to allow this to happen,
just for clarification, Colonel, are you talking about what the Chinese say in Mandarin to their own people, or as opposed to what they say in English to the rest of the world? Or is it evident, this kind of bellicosity in what they say in English for us as well?
The English is bad enough. The venom, the vitriol, it's clear. And you could squeeze it and you'd probably fill up a 50-gallon oil drum in a few minutes. It's that bad. So when you do have what you've described as military-age males coming across the border with no excuse for why they're there, that somebody ought to be paying attention. And this is just a huge, huge failing. And whatever administration it is, Republican or Democrat, they have an obligation to protect us. And this is not a good thing. You know what?
Let me ask you one aspect of this, Colonel, because, again, you have a lot of military experience as a Marine. You know, insurgencies and counterinsurgencies are something that you've had familiarity with, personal, firsthand familiarity with. One of the things that I find particularly alarming about all of this is not just who these young men seem to be. And by the way, one of our eyes on guys in all of this is Michael Yon, who I think you know, a former special operator, now a very accomplished and quite courageous war correspondent, who has been monitoring these flows of young Chinese nationals, seemingly PLA elements, coming through the Darien Gap. And he says they pretend not to speak English, but he's used a technique for demonstrating that they actually do understand English. So it's not just who these characters are, and it's not just that they are being moved up in numbers that could be, you know, sizable elements of Chinese battalions, but that they're being disseminated all over the country at taxpayer expense, as are these other illegal aliens. What are the implications, sir? If their mission is to cause havoc behind our lines in the event of a shooting war someplace else, and naturally, we would be mobilizing forces, we would be moving elements to railheads, to ports, and so on, to respond to the threat overseas. What would you anticipate might be their mission, sir?
Well, I would suggest hitting, say, infrastructure targets, and these can be even very small things, like power transformers. We've seen this happen already, where these small sort of devices kind of out in the middle of nowhere get hit, and it causes all sorts of problems. And that's, you know, very juicy targets. But also remember the problems that were caused by the DC sniper back in the early 2000s. This was like a guy and a half who pretty much shot
two individuals, right?
Well, it was a guy and a half. It was a guy and a youngster.
Okay, a young boy.
But yeah. It was two individuals, that's right. But remember the trouble that caused. Both the physical, psychological, absolutely discombobulated the place. Well, so we've heard the figure 10,000 people have come across the border. What if it's only 1,000? Let's say 20 a state, and say half of those do a DC sniper sort of thing. Instead of just DC, you've got it all over the world. All over the US. And that alone is a huge problem. And that's just a couple ideas that you can think of off the top of your head. If you're criminally minded or intent on causing real mayhem, I would suggest there's more that you can do.
Colonel, that's worrying enough. The prospect that the Chinese may have a military base in Cuba from which to support such insurgent operations is also very alarming. You and I have talked about this in the past, and I know you're concerned that that base could already be housing, who knows, missiles, perhaps, biological weapons, other kinds of offensive capabilities, cyber not least. But you also appreciate, because again, we've discussed this in previous visits with you, that it's not just Cuba that China is penetrating. It's really all of our hemisphere, and most alarmingly, I guess, other parts of the Caribbean and Latin America. Give us your read on what all that might mean when China attacks.
Well, suppose that you've got a Latin America which is anti-American, doesn't allow you to move your ships around. It gives harbor to Chinese military elements. They're going to close off the Panama Canal first thing. You have Chinese companies that run, that control each end of it. That's going to be gone. But you see this, I say, throughout the entire continent. So where we're now focusing on Cuba, you know, having discovered gravity, apparently, it's the rest of Latin America that most of it has gone under. And is just a few countries that are not in China's camp. They have been very successful in getting their people in. People who've been down in Argentina and southern Argentina, Chile, recently, they talk about the Chinese presence down there all the time, and it is immense. And recently, the Chinese have been stirring up the Argentinians to go after the British on the Falklands. So that's just what we need, is another war down in the South Atlantic. China's Navy will be operating.
Which the Brits would not be able to do much about, I fear, in that circumstance. I don't think we helped them the last time around. Yeah. Colonel, I have to ask you to hold the thought, because this is a topic that I want to develop a little bit further with you. It's critically important that we understand what could be done with, well, what I say is the hemisphere in their hands. We'll be right back with more with Colonel Grant Newsom right after this. Stay tuned.
Destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're continuing our very special conversation with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps, retired, the author of a terrific new book, When China Attacks, A Warning to America. He is also a very frequent contributor to various periodical journals and has been incredibly, I think, influential in his contributions to our work at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, which proud to say he is an important member. Colonel, you were developing the thought that if China has now not only established beachheads in places like Cuba, but in Argentina and Chile and certainly Brazil, and indeed, I think it's fair to say, most of the rest of the continent as well, some of which involve simple commercial activities on a very, very high level, some of which have also given them access to infrastructure, facilities like ports, for example. What are the implications of all of that if, as we've been discussing, we may find ourselves in a shooting war that will require our use of, sea lines of communication that could well be impacted?
Well, if we can play this out for a little while, say a number of years, say 5-10 years, you're going to find the Chinese Navy operating in all of these ports throughout Latin America. And that at a minimum is going to require us to cover the place. We don't even have enough ships now to fight a war in the Western Pacific. Suddenly you have to devote all these resources to, as I said, covering down to our south in Latin America. That alone is a problem, much less having to fight anybody. And there's a political aspect to it where you have almost all of Latin America clamoring at the United Nations for the Americans to back off for having provoked a fight with China, et cetera, et cetera. Not a good thing, to put it mildly. So it just gets a bit worse the farther out you look. But you have correctly identified this over the last 20 years, how the Chinese have built up massive port airfield infrastructure in Latin America, and they are now the dominant economic power when it comes to business with the Latin American nations. my book actually has a before and after schematic of this, and it goes from almost zero Chinese presence to pretty much entirely Chinese presence. And that has happened on successive administrations' watches, and Department of Defense has never seen it as a priority. And you're starting to see why this 20 years of this misspent fight in Afghanistan and Iraq was a pretty bad thing to have happen to us while that was going
strategically
on.
Strategically costly.
Our Absolutely. Back door was just getting subverted. Now it's bad.
Yeah. And Colonel, I think to cast this in the proper perspective, it's not just the Chinese, of course, the Russians and the Iranians, their allies, strategic partners, have also been insinuating themselves. We've literally seen, I think it's no exaggeration to say, the hemisphere from the Arctic in the north to the Antarctic in the south coming under the sway of regimes that are, if not outright hostile themselves, certainly aligned with those who are, and allowing the presence of very dangerous foreign powers in their midst, economically, yes, but strategically as well. I salute you for calling attention to this, sir, and I pray that we are starting to see people in the U.S. government now serving, whether in uniform or out, who are going to recognize the urgent need to take corrective action, if we still can. Speaking of which, let me ask you about this recent event in which a balloon, a high-altitude, lighter-than-air vehicle, carrying a payload the equivalent of three buses, traversed the United States, doing, we're told, figure eights over some of the most sensitive facilities in our military, nuclear forces, as well as conventional ones. We are now being told by the administration not only that this is a silly balloon that interfered temporarily with our discourse, our coupling, if you will, with China, but also that we were considering the matter closed. We're now actually being told by a senior U.S. military officer that not to worry, folks, during those 8 days transiting the United States, this surveillance asset of the Chinese Communist Party did not collect any intelligence and did not transmit any of it back to China. I'm not asking you for access to classified information, which I suspect you no longer have, nor would you share if you did, Colonel, but just a sanity check, a reality check, whatever you want to call it. Could that possibly be true in your professional judgment, sir?
I wouldn't bet 5 cents on it being true. It could be, of course, but why should we believe these people? If you look at the whole balloon saga from the beginning, there's been 4 or 5 different stories about it from the time it was first spotted. And if some guy in Montana hadn't looked up and taken a picture of it, you can bet we'd have heard nothing more of it. Unfortunately, once credibility is shot, it's just impossible to believe what these guys say. Combine this with the fact they will not release the results of the investigation, which they said they were going to do, and they haven't done it. So once again, you got to get your story straight. And unfortunately, this is just not believable. It's really hate to say it, but it's about as credible as those, what you'd hear about those, the afternoon follies at the in Vietnam, where the command would put out these reports that became to be a joke. And unfortunately, when the Pentagon and its spokesmen opened their mouths, even guys like us who really wanted to believe it or want to trust them, we just can't. So this is one that it looks as, quite possibly it's the administration, as you said, they're suppressing this so it can get in the rearview mirror in exchange for the broader, more important U.S.-China relationship. Well, maybe this balloon incident actually tells you everything you need to know about the nature of the relationship. So if we're that dumb, well, you Gotta hand it to the Chinese. You can't blame them. But I do not believe what this fellow said.
I concur strongly. Let me ask you about sort of the context a bit more broadly, sir, because, again, you've served in uniform in senior positions. You've been both a Foreign Service officer and an attaché in the U.S. Embassy in Japan. You've had a lot of exposure to intelligence over the course of your career. And again, I'm not asking you to disclose anything sensitive, but would you suggest, can come to the conclusion, if we cannot trust what we're being told by people claiming to have access to this intelligence, things that seem palpably untrue, that there is now very far advanced a politicization of intelligence, if not actually a weaponization of intelligence, among others, against us here in the United States. But how do you perceive what, you know, this episode, but others of which it is a part, you know, what does it tell us about what important elements of our national security capabilities are currently configured to do?
Well, it's, you know, caused a real lack of trust, lack of confidence in what, I'll just speak about the intelligence community. It's not as if Department of Defense has actually covered itself in glory in this regard either. Used to hear, you know, there was always a light at the end of the tunnel. We were just about to win in Afghanistan. We probably won 20 times and nobody seems to have noticed. So, as I say, it's a lack of confidence, a lack of trust. So that's the military. But the intelligence world, I'm afraid that over about the last decade, roughly, that you are now seeing it used for political purposes. And at least when I used to know an awful lot about it, back then, nobody would have ever thought of, say, using intelligence to support an whatever an administration's scheming was. But now, unfortunately, I don't think that the trust is there. I'm very troubled with what has happened. You saw it particularly, say, in the so-called Russia collusion business and everything that happened after that. And it actually happened before that. It reflects the kind of people who were in charge and who have taken once were fairly respected organizations and have now made them something less respected, put it mildly.
Well, and beyond respect, less valuable for the purposes that they are, you know, created and operated.
Well, that's also
perform.
A good part of it is they don't seem to be able to spy properly. You know, look at the thing. They can't tell us where the COVID virus came from. They were even saying, well, that nobody knew about the Chinese in Cuba. Just one thing after another, that it doesn't seem as though they have got the assets to provide the information that the country needs. But it is a certain type at the very top who went too far and saw themselves as sort of courtiers almost of an administration or two. And so we're not in good shape at all in this regard.
No, we aren't. We have to wrap on this point. I think this warrants a separate conversation, hopefully with you and others soon, about Bill Burns, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, a former Foreign Service officer as well, of course, but a man who has seemingly been very much involved in the political aspects or political agenda, if you will, of the intelligence community. We'll get into that in the future with you, sir, I hope, as well as others. God bless you. Thank you for your work with us at the Center for Security Policy, sir, and your great new book, When China Attacks. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you next time, I hope. Until then, go forth and multiply.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In 1944, Adolf Hitler ordered his army to torch Paris rather than let the city be liberated intact. As it became clear he was being disobeyed, the Nazi dictator frantically demanded to know, "Is Paris burning?" Thankfully, it wasn't then, but the capital of France is burning today at the hands of adherents to another totalitarian ideology, best described as Sharia supremacism, who now occupy hundreds of no-go zones across the country. And it is not just Paris that is in flames. In recent days, jihadists have taken to the streets in city after city, ostensibly to protest the killing of a Muslim youth by police during a traffic stop. The uprisings may prove, however, to be the start of a civil war that unassimilable Islamist immigrants have long aspired to launch in France and far beyond. Think Summer of Love on steroids. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He's a friend of many years, a man I've admired even before I've gotten to know him, but most especially appreciate the cumulative work that he has done for decades now, telling the truth about the jihad that has been waged against the people of Israel by assorted enemies, both Sunni and Shia, of various nationalities, but most especially those closest to the Jewish state, namely the Palestinians. His name is Itamar Marcus. His group is called Palestinian Media Watch. You can follow this incredibly important organization and its, well, insights into the dangers that Israel has been facing from an enemy within, as well as immediately adjacent to the Jewish state, at palwatch.org. Itamar has most recently done a new program, a new booklet called Teaching Terror to Tots, and a brand new video, which he's going to talk to us about in response to some of the reporting about the recent and ongoing violence between the Israelis and assorted Palestinians, notably of late in a Palestinian refugee camp called Jenin. Itamar, it is great to have you back on Securing America. I hate to say that what seems afoot here is just proof positive of what you've been warning about for many, many years. I encourage you to, you know, explain to us what, as you see it, is going on at the moment and what is not going on at the moment, despite efforts by the BBC and Western media of other stripes to assure us that, in fact, what we're witnessing is brutal and indiscriminate bloodlust and killing by the Palestinians, of the Palestinians, by the Israel Defense Forces, Jewish settlers, and others. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Frank. What's happening is something that is so obvious. It's a defensive measure that every country would take, given the kind of terror that Israel has been suffering from. Over the last year, we've lost over 50 people, almost all of them civilians, to terror attack. And most of those terror attacks have originated from Jenin. Jenin became, in the Palestinian Authority eyes and in the Palestinian terrorist eyes, a city of refuge. In the center of the city, they had all these bomb factories. And their storage facilities for the weapons were everywhere, including inside mosques and in under the floors of mosques. This was the source of terror. So Israel did now what it really should have done even months ago is it went in and surgically, and I say surgically because it didn't indiscriminately bomb, and it didn't even kill one civilian as far as we know. They sent in 1,000 soldiers, top soldiers, and as far as the reports are, not even one of them was a civilian. And they went building to building, going to where they knew from intelligence sources where the weapons were, where the terrorists were. Most of the terrorists, by the way, ran away into hiding. A lot of them actually threw down their guns and sort of ran out of the city with a lot of civilians who ran away. But Israel did what it had to do, and it did it very, very well. And altogether, I don't know, the numbers aren't final yet, 15 or so, 18 or so Palestinians. Again, so far, all of them have been terrorists. Now, you mentioned that...
Let me just say, Itamar, for purposes of calibration here, there is arguably no more difficult military task than clearing a densely packed urban area, especially in the face of hostile fire from within that area. And the extent to which what you've just described has been not only accomplished, but is obviously the object of the exercise, is to reduce a mortal peril to innocent Israelis emanating from this kind of community without harming innocent Palestinians. And how innocent they are, and how many of them, you know, are actually in the fight is always a further very dangerous aspect of all of this. But I mean, my hat's off to the Israeli Defense Forces for what they've done so far. But also, I think it's very, very important for us to appreciate that Israel had essentially no choice but to try to take down these cells and these arsenals that were being mobilized for the purposes of killing innocents.
Well, you're absolutely right. It was no choice, and it was 100%, I would say, even an obligation. Israel's first obligation is to protect its civilians from terror. As far as the numbers, again, aren't final, but there were hundreds of hand grenades that were found. There were many, many bombs. There were bomb factories that were found, weapons, dozens of M16 rifles. It was literally an arsenal that was all intended to be used against Israeli civilians. So this was something that was completely justified. Now, in spite of the fact of how carefully Israel behaved, the United Nations, as well as BBC, have blamed Israel for the deaths of children. And as soon as we saw those accusations, we actually already yesterday tweeted, and today we're preparing a video where you see three of the four children who they're defining as children in Israel. In fact, the BBC journalist said Israel is happy to kill children, which is, of course, absurd. It's an absolute libel. But we used to put the pictures of the children. And what's so interesting and so significant is that one of them is wearing a headband of Islamic Jihad, one of them is wearing a headband of Hamas, and the other one is carrying a rifle as well. All three of them are in rifles. Two of them actually have all the ammunition and flak jacks on them as well. These are 16 and 17-year-old active terrorists.
Hold this thought. We're going to come right back with more with Itamar Marcus, the director of Palestinian Media Watch, a critical force for good in Israel. Be right back. We're back, and we're continuing a very important conversation, corrective on much of what you probably have been hearing about the attacks that have been taking place in Israel, both attacks by Palestinians against Israelis. Well, actually, you probably haven't been hearing so much about that, but about the attacks by Israel Defense Forces against certain Palestinian strongholds, organized terrorist cells, and their arsenals. Our guest is Itamar Marcus, the director of Palestinian Media Watch, and a formidable force for good, I believe, in the business of truth-telling about what Israel is up against and why it must defend itself against murderous jihadis, some of whom masquerade as partners for peace in Israel. Itamar, I hated to interrupt you, but you were talking about the tragic, yes, loss of life on the part of several youngsters in the Jenin camps that were unfortunately, apparently, being used, as these jihadis do, as instruments of war against, in this case, Israelis. Give us a little bit more texture on that. And the work that you do so brilliantly is rebutting with the facts the kinds of slanders that you've just described out of the BBC. We're going to have some of the footage of your response to it in an important video that you've just done. But just give us a little bit of texture on that subject, if you would, as well.
Well, Palestinian Media Watch has been exposing for years that the Palestinian Authority has been literally brainwashing its children to believe that being a shaheed, which means a martyr for Allah, is the greatest accomplishment in life, not only for adults, but for children as well. And the children have bought
into
this.
And their mothers even tell them that as well, do they not?
Absolutely. We have released in the last 6 months probably dozens of examples, literally dozens of examples of celebrating their children's death on TV. How happy they were, praise Allah, my son is a martyr. We had even one of these boys who was killed this week, I'm sorry, 2 days ago in Jenin. His sister was interviewed, and we're going to release this tomorrow. You can all find it on our website. His sister was interviewed, and she said, my brother wanted to be a martyr. He wanted to join his friend who already was a martyr, and he achieved what he wanted. So Israel, the Palestinian Authority, brainwashed its kids to put themselves in dangerous situations where they will have a likelihood of dying. The kids think that they're going to be heroes and everyone's going to know their name and they're going to be famous. So the kids are sucked into this trap. We call it the PA's martyrdom trap for children.
But Itamar, it's not some function of their imagination that they will be treated as heroes. They witness it being done all the time. And not only that, talk about what their families get if they wind up being shaheeds, martyrs.
That's right. So their families are honored forever, but they also get paid forever. Family of a child who's killed, or a person who's, or an adult who's killed, for the rest of their lives, will get a monthly stipend of 1,400 shekel, which is about, let's say, $350-$400 for life, because their child was a terrorist, and this includes, for example, families of suicide bombers.
Yeah, am I correct, Itamar, that American funds are now once again being made available for this purpose, despite federal law prohibiting it?
This money comes to the Palestinian terrorists from the Palestinian Authority. It is in Palestinian Authority law to pay these people these monthly stipends. American law has prohibited giving the Palestinian Authority, Taylor Force Act, for 4 years now, prohibits giving any money to the Palestinian Authority until they cancel this law. But what the new administration has been doing, the Biden administration, is they've been bypassing the law, finding all sorts of categories that they're claiming the law doesn't limit the funding. So the Palestinian Authority is now getting, through various frameworks and through various NGOs, hundreds of millions of dollars are going, which of course frees up so that the PA can continue rewarding terrorists. To the tune of about $350 million a year. That's how much money they are giving.
This is simply staggering. And the fact that we are not getting this kind of information from most of the media. It's not just the BBC folks by any means. It's all kinds of press, including those we describe as the papers of record and like in the United States. Itamar, you had an opportunity, I'm very pleased to see, last week to testify before Congressman Chris Smith's subcommittee in the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And Chris Smith has been a champion of human rights throughout his distinguished career, about anti-Semitism and its manifestations. I think what you've been describing here and the blood libels and the like about Israel are a part of that. But give us just a quick essence of your testimony and how it was received on the Hill.
Well, they wanted to know about Palestinian Authority anti-Semitism, which even that itself is an excellent change in American attitude. American attitude has always been that Israel is responsible for the conflict because of territory. Once you recognize that the Palestinian Authority, with its blind hatred, with its blind anti-Semitism, is the source of the conflict, you're actually changing the entire equation. And that's what this was all about. And what I showed them and what I documented for them with all the quotes, the Palestinian Authority is not only anti-Semitic, but their whole national identity and ideology is based on anti-Semitism. And I'll give this to you in a nutshell. The Palestinian Authority says that Jews are evil, they're racist, they're terrible. Everyone in the world, the Europeans did massacres all these centuries against the Jews because of the Jews' behavior. Jews are hated because of the behavior. And then finally, what do they say? The Europeans decided we have to solve our Jewish problem and we're going to steal Palestine and give it to the Jews, even though the Jews have no history there. That's what they're claiming is the origin of Israel's existence. Everybody hates the Jews. Everybody wanted to get rid of the Jews. So the Palestinian Authority is now, or the Palestinians are the ones who suffered. Now, Palestinians hate the Jews today, but they say, we're justified. Everyone hates the Jews, and for good reason.
And unfortunately, much of this is to be found in the teachings of Islam, the Quran, Sharia. So I'm so sorry we have to cut this off. We're out of time, but I hope you will come back to us with updates on this frequently. Itamar, you're right at the cusp of, I think, a breakthrough on so many fronts, and we appreciate your great work at Palestinian Media Watch, palwatch.org. Check it out, folks. And then come back to us next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.